The hour of 10:15 have arrived. We'll call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum, but we will get started. Members, I'm going to switch it up a little bit here. We're going to do House File 3411 from yesterday first. Then we're going to go to House File 3329 next. Then we're going to skip over 3566 because we have some folks that had driven in from that want to testify on House File 2716, the Drazkowski bill. So we will go to that third, and we'll see if we have time for my bill at the end. We'll just see, because I want to give the department the time they need for House File 3411 for the Davids bill. Okay, is there any? Okay, we have Mr. Cummings here, and I've got a Shane Rudlang, City of Bloomington, Joel Carlson, and a Jill Larson to testify. Is there anyone wish? Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on behalf of House File 3411? Is there anyone that wishes to testify against the chairman's bill? Okay, we're in good order today. Looks good. Okay, so when we have a quorum, Mr. Cummings, I will move House File 3411. And so if you could please, and I guess there are there's one amendment. Is that the right bill? Okay, so we'll get in the shape that we like once we have a quorum. So if you could please describe the bill as if it's amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. We appreciate the opportunity to come before this committee today. We thought, this is not the main attraction, Mr. Chair. This is, you know, a smaller but very beneficial attraction. We thought that we might milk this hearing for all it's worth. Sometimes the policy bill is like herding cattle, but maybe if you move this bill pronto and provide a fair hearing, this is a grand champion bill. Is this working, Mr. Chair?
Not at all.
Okay. So we appreciate you offering the amendment, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to again thank our staff and your staff, Mr. Chair. Our attorneys and our researchers and our staff within our divisions have been working hard to identify many of these solutions.
No, Mr. Cummings, it was working. It was working. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, for an example of some of the good work is in Article 1, Sections 3 and 4. This was work that was done with local units of government that Mr. Gustafson will describe in a moment. I just wanted to lift up, as I did yesterday, that Article 3 is dealing with some language that deals with partnership tax, and we have been working with Minnesota Partners, and we'll continue to work with Minnesota Partners to try and find a solution that really tries to meet many of the ideas that we're hearing. We have a meeting. We've had meetings with the business community in the bar about this, and we have another one scheduled for next Monday. I did also receive an email this morning from Mr. Dale Busacker that was very helpful in identifying some specific items within the bill. In addition, Mr. Chair, I'll, when we get to the part in Article 2 dealing with the local lodging tax, we will I can describe a little bit more about that because we've heard some feedback about that. I guess with that, Mr. Chair, I think we will move to Article 1, and Mr. Gustafson will be outlining those provisions.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Mr. Gustafson, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kyle Gustafson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I'll be covering Article 1 of the Department's policy bill dealing with property tax. Section 1 amends the Small Cities Assistance Aid Program to clarify that the Commissioner of Transportation would certify aid amounts under that program to the Commissioner of Revenue by June 1st of each year. Section 2 addresses Board of Assessor sanctions procedures by specifying that the Department of Revenue would make recommendations on sanctions to the Board. And this section would also clarify those procedures for a licensee to appeal a decision with respect to sanctions to the Office of Administrative Hearings. Section 3 and 4 are somewhat related. First of all, in Section 3, this would increase the threshold for filing a certificate of real estate value from $1,000 to $3,000. And similarly, in Section 4, this would change the minimum consideration that's covered under the minimum deed tax, raising it from $500 to $3,000 as well. Sections 3 and 4 was something we worked with counties over the last year on in reaching that $3,000 amount. And that concludes Article 1.
Okay, questions for members on Article 1? Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give me a better, more detailed description about this minimum deed tax and what we're doing here exactly?
Mr. Gustafson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson. Currently, any transaction where the consideration for the transfer of property, where it's $500 or less, so it could be for no money at all or a nominal amount of money, the person who's recording that deed pays $1.65. That's the minimum deed tax. And so what this would do is make all transactions that are $3,000 or less subject to the $1.65 minimum deed tax. And then anything over that, the $3,000 or more, would be subject to the calculation provided in the statute, which is 0.33%. So at $3,000, that's $9.90.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other questions on Article 1? Members, we do have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. I will, Representative Schultz moves the minutes of Wednesday, March 14th, 2018. Any discussion? Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Schultz. Item next, I will move House File 3411. I will move the author's amendment. Is this that's an author's amendment? Author's amendment A18-0606. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. We now have the bill before us as amended to Article 2.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Susan Berry will outline the provisions in Article 2.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair, members. My name is Susan Berry. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. I'll be going through Article 2. So Sections 1, 2, and 3 are related provisions. They concern cancellations of sales tax permits. Section 1 amends the department's disclosure law to authorize the department to disclose to anyone whether the department has canceled a sales tax permit when the reason for cancellation is that the permit was not issued in conformity with the requirements for issuing a sales tax permit. We do currently have the authority to disclose to anyone regarding revocation and also to disclose regarding any cancellation if there is an inquiry. So this would allow us to disclose the cancellation without the inquiry in those instances where it was issued without conformity with the requirements. And then connected with that is Sections 2 and 3. They amend sections in the sales tax chapter that deal with the issuance of and cancellation of sales tax permits. The purpose of these amendments is to allow the commissioner to cancel a sales tax permit that should not have been issued in the first place. The issue this language addresses is the ability of taxpayers with large liabilities, often hundreds of thousands of dollars, who are not paying their tax liabilities, who, when faced with possible revocation of their sales tax permit for non-payment, will register online for a new sales tax permit. Since their current sales tax permit has not been revoked at the time they apply for the new permit, the department is currently required to issue the new permit. Even though subsequently their original permit may be revoked, they continue to operate under the new sales tax permit. The department can then begin the process of revocation on the second permit, starting with notice to the taxpayer of our intent to revoke if the liability is not paid, and the taxpayer tries to keep the cycle going by applying for a new sales tax permit before the second permit is revoked. So to end the cycle of tax evasion, the amendment prohibits the department from issuing a new sales tax permit if the applicant owes delinquent sales tax. And if the registration went through in spite of tax being owed, it allows the department to cancel a new permit because it should not have been issued in the first place. An exception is provided when the taxpayer has appealed the unpaid tax liability. However, once the appeal is ended, if the taxpayer does not prevail and the tax liability remains, the department would be allowed to cancel a new sales tax permit. The amendment also provides the department must provide notice to the permit holder of the cancellation and a permit holder has the right to provide information to the department to show that his permit was issued in conformity with the law. Sections 4 and 5 regarding the local lodging tax. You know, we have over 100 local lodging taxes. I believe there's 112 now, and four of these are administered by the department. Section 4 provides that the local lodging tax is due on the entire consideration paid for access to the lodging, including ancillary or related services, such as the services of accommodations intermediaries, as defined in general sales tax law. Section 5 provides that in collecting the local lodging tax, for those local governments that do not have department administer the tax, the local ordinance may require annual remittance and filing of lodging taxes by the accommodations intermediaries. And if the ordinance does so, then the due date of the tax and the return is October 20th each year. The local government must inform the accommodations intermediaries of the due date and also provide them electronically with the geographic and zip code information necessary to apply the tax.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, accommodation intermediaries are online lodging or travel providers who resell rooms. So this proposal, as Ms. Berry mentioned, makes it clear that lodging tax does apply to the sales price of the lodging as paid by the consumer, including the elements that go into that sales price, regardless if it was sold by the hotel or an accommodations intermediary. For instance, Mr. Chair, if you bought a book from a store, and then the store argued that the sales price for the purposes of some of the sales taxes should be the wholesale price paid by the retailer and not the retail sales price paid by the consumer, it would be inconsistent on how we treat sales price. We can't say that the wholesale sales price is the price, and then the cost and stocking and selling of the book at the retail store is a service that is different than the sales price as a service. Consumers see one price, which is the sales price, and that is where the tax should be levied. So whatever makes up the price that a consumer pays, whether the wholesale price of the room or the accommodations intermediary fee, it should be subject to the tax generally. If this committee wants to think about tax rates or the amount of tax levied, then that's a different discussion than ensuring that we have a consistent tax base. In determining whether to apply the tax to to lodging-related services, it should not matter who administers the local lodging tax, the local government or the Department of Revenue, nor should it matter where the lodging tax is authorized under general law or special law. It is important that taxes, when authorized, are generally applied fairly and consistently across the state. And that ends our presentation on Article 2, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. On that whole lodging tax thing, I can't remember what my position is on that.
Mr. Chair, I think
that Mr. Cummings,
in the words of Mr. O'Rourke from yesterday, you're the author of this bill.
I thought it was Mark Horton Reese that did that.
You know, this is a page-turner. This is really something. Okay, let's go to some member questions on Article 2, right?
Article 2. Chair Anderson, then Representative Hertas, Chair Erickson. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what I understand is that, so if you're like Orbitz, or I can't even remember all the different online versions, they would have to also remit the tax. But then when you say ancillary services, does that also include, like, I have a hotel in my community that has a gym in the hotel. So if you're using the gym, are you paying a lodging tax on that or any of the other pieces that are part of it? Kind of give me a little better of a rundown of what you consider ancillary or related services.
Sure.
Ms. Berry.
Chair and Representative Anderson. Ancillary services could include if you have a separate fee that you would charge your guest if they were to use your gym, that would be included as an ancillary service. It also could be if you charge them for bringing up an extra cot. You know, all the different charges that they may have for you, those would be considered ancillary.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess what I'm asking is, I have a hotel that actually has a gym that people from the community, like a Lifetime Fitness, think of it in those terms, okay? So it's not just hotel guests that are using it. It's people in the community that aren't resting their head there that use that facility. Would they then now have to pay a lodging tax based upon this language?
So,
Mr. Cummings?
So just to clarify, Representative Anderson and Mr. Chair, you're saying that if there was a transaction that was unrelated to a lodging transaction, if they bought a membership or some type of transaction that just dealt with the fitness and had nothing to do with an overnight stay, how would that be treated for the purposes of lodging taxes?
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair,
Barry?
Representative Anderson, the answer is that in that case, I mean, if anyone's just they're buying the membership, if that would not be considered an ancillary service because it's not part of the lodging.
Chair Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess then outside of, you know, ordering this online, having reserving a room online, what is all included in ancillary? I guess that's my concern. I can understand that you want to just limit it to, I guess, to me, it seems really broad and vague.
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I think what the intent is to try and say if a customer is having many delineations of various fees on their lodging tax receipt that go into the whole transaction, that all of the whole transaction is should be part of the sales price rather than if they were to delineate on the receipt to say, to stay overnight here, it's $10 for the room, but then it's $90 for the service of staying in the room, right, for a $100 fee overall. So I think it's just trying to ensure that the complete transaction of lodging is. But maybe Ms. Berry can highlight,
Ms. Berry,
what that list might be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, related services, as I suggested earlier, could include things as if a hotel is going to charge you for a cot, if they're going to charge you for delivering an iron, that kind of thing, could be for the telephone service. But what this language with the local, what we're trying to get at here is regarding the accommodations intermediary, the services that they provide in facilitating getting access to the lodging, and whether it's by a hotel, a resort, you know, whatever. Because they often, I mean, they will not only charge what the hotel says that they can charge, but they have their services for facilitating the sale as well, and there's a charge for that, and that would be a related service, for example.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Cohen,
and as it relates to, I think that we have this sort of fee for getting a cot, you know, issue, but then when we're talking about this accommodation intermediary service, what I think what we're seeing in terms of remittance, or some local units of government are, is that there's a room charge part that is being remitted with the local lodging tax, but then there's accommodations intermediary. But the customer doesn't see that difference on their bill, right? So they're going to see the fee for the cot, but they're not going to see the difference between an accommodations intermediary service and the room charge that they're delineating and then remitting to the local unit of government. And so if the customer is only seeing one fee or one room charge for the service, that is the point in which we're trying to bring up to this committee that should be treated equitably, just like any other lodging charge across the state. Because the customer is seeing only one price.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, maybe the best way to look at this would be to say that we don't want to go in lodging the way we have gone in airline, where there is a fee to fly on the airplane, but then there's another fee for if you have an overhead bag, and there's another fee if you check a bag, and there's a fee for this and a fee for that. So basically what this is saying is we don't care whether they itemize or not in a lodging tax, but if this is a fee that you're paying because you are lodging there for cable television service, for internet service, for telephone service, for an extra cot, for extra towels, for access to the health, you know, the spa that is located in the hotel. We don't care whether you're charging it individually or if you're charging it as just part of the whole room fee. All of it is taxable. Sure. And that's under current law. That isn't really a change in our current law. Really what this is picking up is just the accommodations intermediary.
All right. So by that makes it much more clear. I appreciate that. But overall, what we're doing in essence is making it more expensive for consumers to stay if they book their hotel online, right? Because you're including the intermediary.
Ms. Dahlberg.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Maybe we
can
talk about vaping or something that's not true.
You're correct. There will be a sales tax on the accommodations intermediary. The question is, are they subject as an ancillary tax right now? And this is maybe clarifying, you know, whether it's where you want to go in clarification or not. I think that's maybe the way to think about this.
Chair Anderson?
No, I'm sorry.
Mr. Cummings?
I think in terms of it is not whether it is booked online. If a person were to go to Hilton.com or HowardJohnson.com or HolidayInn.com, they would need to pay the local lodging tax on the entire, you know, on the entire consideration of the room. These are for the online, the accommodations intermediaries. So it is not online versus online, right? Because some online transactions are making the case that they can delineate between these services. But if it's a hotel-based website, they have to pay the local lodging tax on the entire consideration. If it's a third-party website with an accommodations intermediary, they are making the case that they can pay it on the room charge, but not on the accommodations intermediary. But the consumer doesn't know the difference, right? The consumer does not see anything delineated between the two. So it is not a question of whether it is online. It is a question of which website to go to.
Okay, Representative Hertox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Cummins. Ms. Berry, you were talking a little bit about Subdivision 3 under Article 2 about permits not issued. In the conversations we've had in other committees this week, actually, with regard to revocations of licenses, whether it's a driver's license or a business license, a professional license, I'm a little bit concerned the way the language is written here. If an individual's expertise is in a certain enterprise, if it's retailing or if it's lodging or whatever, in order for that person to be in business because his business is exposed to taxable sales, he can't really legally be in business without your sales and use tax permit. So my question to you is, if the individual owes taxes and needs to continue working to repay the debt that that individual has to the state of Minnesota, is it not counterintuitive to put somebody out of business so they never pay the taxes? And it sounds like to me you're not willing to issue a sales and use tax permit if you owe any taxes. But how do you pay the taxes if you can't work?
Ms. Berry?
Mr. Chair, Representative, revocation of a sales tax permit is one of the tools that we have for enforced collection. When the department has tried many times to work with the taxpayer to have them pay their liability, these are liabilities that the taxpayer perhaps has not even asked for a hearing when we've said, you know, if you don't pay the liability, we intend to go forward with revocation. So they may not even have requested a hearing. If it's found that they owe the liability, you know, if they're not all the way along, if they're not willing to work with the department, if they're not willing to enter into a payment plan, and that's Most people are. Most people that have liabilities and are not able to pay it off right away, they will work with the department. They will have a payment plan. But there are some taxpayers out there that they're trying to make as much money as they can, I mean, which is great, but they're trying to do that also by not paying the sales tax. So they're collecting the sales tax, which is a trust tax, and they're not turning it over to the state. And so these are the kind of people that we're talking about here, Representative, where they're not willing to pay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Ms. Berry, I guess, you know, I would think it would be a little bit better to have some language in there that clarifies, you know, that provision which you talked about, an exception if there is a payment plan, because it doesn't say that in here. It just basically says if you owe a delinquent tax, you're not going to get another permit. And I would be concerned about that. You know, a lot of people go into foreclosure on their house and they don't pay their house mortgage because not because they don't necessarily have income, but they have other mitigating circumstances that are unanticipated. And if it was really easy to be in business, everybody would be in business. And stuff does happen. So I'm a little concerned that we need to fix that just a little bit to make sure that rather than just item B as explicitly as it says, under this statute basically says we don't care about your payment plan or a plan that you're proposing, that we have all the authority here just basically to put you out of business. I think it's the exception of all the businesses that are around that have sales and use tax permits. I think the circumstances you're describing is trying to fix a problem. I understand that part, but I think it would be punitive to the rest of the businesses that maybe find themselves in an economic downturn or for whatever reason, you know, aren't able to pay the collected tax and need to work something out. So that's my comments.
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to note that I think you're right, Representative Perkins. This is absolutely the exception. There are thousands and thousands of businesses across the state that do a great job at collecting and remitting taxes, and we are thankful for that work and partnership. As Ms. Berry mentioned, that this is a trust tax. This is collected but not remitted. And many times we also hear from businesses around the other taxpayers that talk about being at a competitive disadvantage. You know, a neighboring business that sells the same thing has collected, you know, $500,000 of sales tax but not remitted it. And they're, you know, putting that back into their business, and, you know, I'm just trying to make this work according to the laws. And so if we've got people that have different sets of laws out there in order to follow, that creates a competitive issue. Now, what we found with other things like liquor posting, liquor posting is an area of sometimes high noncompliance, but liquor posting is a way that keeps it on there. But in terms of so one of the things that we want to work with you and think about in terms of the payment plan is that they may set up a payment plan and then get whatever sort of permits they need or they buy new or able to buy new product, and then they default on the payment plan, right? And so we want to ensure that we have a way to ensure that, you know, that we're helping out the people that are sort of following the law out there and able to try and ensure that we're not carrying a continued liability. Sometimes when we are in these situations, I know that we've worked with you, Mr. Chair, on a few of them, is if we're in a situation in which there's a taxpayer that has a high amount of debt, and then there's a time in which we work to extend that debt, it's only, you know, finding them to get in a rougher and rougher patch. We found that in some of these situations. And that is, again, that's creating a disadvantage. And also, if our job is to try and ensure that we're collecting the types of remittance from the state, you know, it's further and further getting away from, you know, protecting the state's interests in terms of ensuring that debt is collected. So if they're falling further and further out of compliance.
Mr. Cummings, if somebody owes $500,000 in back sales taxes, which I know they do, why aren't they in jail?
That's another committee, Mr. Chair.
Oh, that'd be civil law. Okay.
Representative Hertaus.
Well, thank you for that explanation, and I understand that. But, you know, the sales tax responsibilities are remitted in regular intervals, not annually. And if you're talking about the kind of money that you've suggested, that would be an incredible amount of sales for a small business. And essentially what I'm talking about here is sometimes I think it's the department's failure to follow up on a delinquent sales tax returns until you have substantial amounts of money before it catches your attention. And then you have the power of levy. You have the power of seizing assets. You have all sorts of other collection tools. My main point is to work with the taxpayer in order that they can continue to pay their debt and allow them to be in their enterprise that they have an expertise in. And for whatever circumstances there are, and I'm sure you've heard a thousand stories as to why sales tax isn't paid, I think, again, you're creating something here for the exception and not the normal circumstances in which people become delinquent on sales tax and actually do rectify the debt that they owe.
And Mr. Chair,
Mr. Cowan,
I think what one of the things that would be helpful is maybe we can find some time with you, Representative Hertaus. I'd love to bring in some of our work people from our collections division to talk to you about how we do work with businesses. I know that I think we really pride ourselves in having good relationships, especially in these times in which things get things maybe not going optimally. And so I really would want to showcase that work.
Thank you, Mr. Cummins. What we're going to do, members, is we have several bills here today. I have a question on our third bill, House File 3566, Liability Collection Remittance Montana Limited. Is there anyone that has traveled more than 50 miles to testify on that bill for it or with concerns? Okay. What we're going to do is we're going to just lay 3411 over. I have a whole list of folks here that have questions. We'll come back to it. I'd like to get the other two bills done, then we'll come back to 3411 yet today, hopefully. If not, I'm not going to push this. There's a lot of good questions on this. And I want the department to have the time they need for this bill. So let's just lay that to the side, and let's go to I will move House File 3329, a collegiate ticket purchasing rights exemption provided. That shouldn't take too long. We're very fortunate today to have with us Mr. Mark Coyle, athletic director of the University of Minnesota, who is going to make some comments on this bill. So, Ms. Dalton, is this the one you're working on? Are you working on this one? The collegiate you guys?
Mr. Chair, yes, I am.
Can you describe to me what it does? So I will move House File 3329.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, essentially what this bill does is it says that if a college has a preferred seating area at a sporting event, and they charge an extra amount to buy a ticket in that preferred seating area, that additional amount is not subject to the sales tax, provided that it is separately stated and the money is used entirely for student scholarships.
Oh, this is a little different, because last year we did the one for the premium seating for the professional teams.
Mr. Chair, this essentially gives the same exemption as there is for the seat licenses for the Vikings Stadium.
The very happy for the Vikings. Okay. Please introduce yourself and let us know who you represent and provide testimony on the bill, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mark Coyle, and I'm the Director of Athletics at the University of Minnesota. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I very much appreciate your time. I also want to specifically thank Chair David for carrying this legislation and for his longtime support of Gopher Athletics and our student athletes. Our scholarship seating donation program is similar to programs that have been standard at schools throughout the country for many years, particularly those in the Power Five conferences, the Big 12, the Big 10, the Pac-12, the SEC, and the ACC. These programs pair requested donations with season ticket purchases to provide essential revenue to athletic departments, especially departments like ours that are responsible for generating the vast majority of operating revenue independent of the greater university. At the University of Minnesota, our scholarship seating donation program includes select season tickets for five of our sports: football, men's and women's basketball, men's hockey, and volleyball. When choosing their season tickets, fans have the option to choose seats in various zones depending on the sport. Each zone reflects a different donation level tied to purchasing seats in that area of the venue. Depending on the sport and the zone, scholarship seating contributions can be as little as $50 per seat. Fans also have the option of selecting season tickets for all five of these sports that have no scholarship seating donation attached to them. So that's what the scholarship seating program is. But why do we have a scholarship seating donation program? Scholarship seating contributions create a complete collegiate experience for Gopher student-athletes by helping the athletics department pay our student-athlete scholarship cost, tuition, fees, books, and room and board. With approximately 700 student-athletes, the athletics department paid more than $12 million in scholarship expenses last fiscal year. In the current fiscal year, we have collected just over $11 million through scholarship seating to help with that expense. As I mentioned earlier, athletics is responsible for generating the vast majority of revenue it needs to operate each year. Just like similar programs at our peer institutions, scholarship seating provides essential revenue to maintain a sustainable operating budget for our department and to keep our student athletes and teams academically and athletically competitive in the Big Ten and the WCHA and around the nation. The sales tax on $11 million in scholarship seating contributions could fund as many as 40 full scholarships for in-state students, young men and women who grew up in Minnesota dreaming of competing for the Golden Gophers. Further, sales tax on scholarship seating donations at the university makes us an outlier in the Big Ten. We're the only Big Ten institution subject to sales tax on these donations. In fact, half of the Big Ten schools do not even pay sales tax on the revenue generated from ticket sales, let alone donations. It is a competitive disadvantage. With that in mind, we are here today to ask for an exemption of the sales tax so we can allocate 100% of scholarship seating donations to supporting the scholarship expenses of Gopher student-athletes. Again, Chair Davids, thank you for your time and members of the committee, and I'm more than happy to take questions if you have any.
Thank you, Director Quayle. I have one question. You know, like, do any of the conferences anymore match up with how many universities they actually represent? Like the Big Ten, you know, it's 14, so when you say half the Big Ten schools, half of 10 is 5, but it's actually 7. How about like the Big 12? Are they like 11 or 15 or?
Mr. Chair, I was an English major in undergrad, so I'm not sure I can help you with the numbers.
I'm not real good at math either. Well, I'm not supposed to say that, am I? Okay. Let's just get a lay of the land here. Is there anyone else wishes to testify on behalf of the bill with concerns thereof? The department?
Not at this time.
Thank you, sir. Okay. Questions? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Doyle Coyle, for that explanation. And I assume that we can get the breakdown by sports so that we can have an understanding of kind of what generates it. I have been wanting, and I will offline be willing to follow this up with you, I have been wanting to relieve our students of a burden that we actually put on many years ago, which is every single student at the University of Minnesota spends $25 per semester to contribute to the Gophers football stadium, whether or not they ever take part in watching a game there, whether or not they care about sports. And it seems to me that, you know, we're under a lot of pressure to reduce costs of higher ed for all students, not just those who are gifted in any one particular area, whether it's academics or athletics or whatever. And I would like to follow up with you on your reaction to us forgiving, using some of this money to forgive students that burden. We were promised at the time it passed that the students would get something special, which I thought was maybe a ticket they could scalp. instead, it was they got their own entrance, which I think would have happened anyhow. At least that's the answer I was given. And so I would really like to explore that with you. Not that athletic scholarships aren't important, but if you've already got $11 million going towards that, taken some off the top to relieve the burden on all the other students on campus, I think is us worth pursuing. And I'd be willing to talk with you about other options as well.
Thank you. Okay, questions for Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Coyle, you mentioned that by allowing this
basically that the preferences would not be taxed, that about 40 scholarships could be provided. Would those scholarships all be for Minnesota students, or would it be for any student athletes? Because if we're going to forego money to the state treasury on this, I would hope that we would maybe have it be devoted for scholarships for students in Minnesota.
Director Coyle?
Chair Davids and Representative, we have, again, about 700 student-athletes, student-athletes from Minnesota, student-athletes from across the country, student-athletes from across the world. And so our scholarship, out of those 700 students, we have about 330 scholarships that we offer those student-athletes. And the breakout just depends on who's recruiting and who's coming to Minnesota. But I understand your comment.
Chair Lone. Any other questions for Director Coyle? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Coyle. There's a couple of questions here that come to my mind, and one is that reducing the tax exemption, do you think you're going to get that much extra in regards to scholarships for this program? And it seems to me that there are two ways of always looking at costs. One is revenue increasing the revenue, and the other one is decreasing the costs. And it seems to me that if we could reduce the cost of college by the 7%, the same dollars would also generate 40 additional scholarships. So, plus, on the rest of it, the state would be able to deal with a lot less student aid as well. So my question to you is do you really envision that because we reduce the tax on here, which I still am for, but, I mean, are you really – maybe. I don't know yet. I'm like you. I haven't convinced myself yet, but – are you really thinking that that's going to generate those additional dollars coming into the scholarship program?
Dr. Quayle?
Yeah, Chair Davis, I may ask Kelly Farmer to come forward with respect to the tax. And
please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Yes,
sir.
Kelly Farmer, the tax director at the University of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee. To the Petersburg question.
Yes, Representative Petersburg, right?
Yes.
The question, if I understand correctly, was how the dollar impact as a result of this provision and whether or not we really will see the benefit come to the university in additional donations to the university. The fact of the matter is this program has been going on for many years, and we have been collecting these scholarship seating donations for many years. And so we want to continue to provide that benefit at that same level that we've provided in the past. Previously, we've looked at this issue as a donation. There was a federal tax law that allows for a charitable contribution, or allowed until January of this year. It allowed for the charitable contribution treatment for part of this amount. And prior to this point in time, we had felt that charitable contributions were not subject to sales tax. With the involvement of the evolution of this particular issue over time, as the other professional teams, stadiums have come online and other revenue generating activities that the professional teams have come on, it's come under the scrutiny of the Department of Revenue and others that this is an area where guidance is needed. And as a result of that recent guidance, this is a tax that we're now subject to, and we would like to, instead of paying the tax, because we've historically treated it as a donation and not subject to sales tax, we would like to be able to continue to do that and pay and use this money for the benefit of the students rather than giving it to the state.
Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, which kind of reminds me of my question about Farm America and its sales tax on its admissions as well, right, Mr. Chair?
Well, that's different.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, the question really is, I understand that you're paying this, but I know that you also have a recruitment process and you generate every year additional revenue sources. So I'm just curious if you really think whether we have this provision in law or not, whether it's really going to impact that significantly to your collections and your ability to do the scholarships. And I'll just leave it at that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Petersburg. Actually, it's kind of the same. We'll talk about that. Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, once again, you have demonstrated your wisdom by authoring this bill. It's a good bill. We should support it and move on to the next bill. Thank you.
Thank you. I agree. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered if Mr. Farmer could clarify. He said that things had just changed in January. Was that the federal tax bill, or was it the Revenue Department is determining that instead of this really being a true charity donation, it is a purchase of an advantage?
Mr. Farmer.
Yes, Chair, Representative. This is prior to January 1st, there was a federal law that allowed for 80% of this payment to be treated as a charitable contribution. And that's been on the books for the past 20-plus years. And so effective January 1st is when the law was changed as a result of the federal law, and we no longer is this an item that can be used as a charitable contribution.
Thank you.
Senator Loffer. I think Representative Loffer brings up a good point, because is it because of the federal tax bill, or is some with a different interpretation of the department?
I don't think that Chair.
Mr. Farmer.
Chair and members, I don't think it's a different interpretation of the department necessarily. I think what we're talking about is that our thinking and how we've considered it to be a charitable contribution, that our thinking has changed over time, and we've been educated in this process as a result of this. And we realize the need for this particular provision to be enacted in order for us to manage our affairs that we have in the past.
Thank you, Mr. Farmer. Any other questions for Director Coyle or Mr. Farmer? Thank you. I will renew my motion to House File 3329 be later for possible inclusion of the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, members, for your questions. Item next, we're going to go to the Drazkowski bill. Chair Drazkowski moves House File 2716. And I believe there are two amendments. Are those both? We'll see if they're both off. Chair Drazkowski moves House File 2716. Chair Drazkowski, are the two amendments both author's amendments?
They are, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so Chair Drazkowski moves the H2716A1 amendment. Discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. We have that amendment. And then Chair Drazkowski moves the H2716A2 amendment. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Chair Drazkowski, two-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 2716 is a bill that is a game changer for the people of the state of Minnesota. The fair tax is a concept that has been discussed for the federal government and by several state legislatures, with a large amount of discussion in the state of Georgia over the past several years. We've recently heard economists talk about the need to increase productivity of workers in the future in our state. Removing the disincentives to work and productivity contained in our current high income tax system in Minnesota will unleash our economy and bring the economic strength that our state will require in the future to weather the demographic realities of baby boomers entering retirement. Mr. Chairman and members, the idea behind a fair tax bill and a fair tax approach repeals the state income tax and the state corporate income tax and a variety of excise taxes, and we can get in the details of those, and then replaces it with a sales tax. And so it would be completely consumption-based and getting rid of the income tax completely, removing those disincentives to work. It also includes a monthly rebate, sometimes called a prebate, that is an amount that is the amount of the sales tax that is charged to people who live at the poverty level. That amount is returned to them and every taxpayer in a monthly rebate form. The Minnesota Department of Revenue's income tax division would disappear, saving our state significant money. The volatility of the state's revenue would be significantly reduced, ending much of the huge swings that we see from corporate and individual income taxes, bringing increased predictability and reducing the occurrences of severity of deficits and surpluses in our state. People would control the amount of taxes that they paid by deciding when to buy goods and services and how much to buy. The plethora of controversial and divisive income tax exemptions and tax expenditures would go away, as the income tax would no longer exist and these taxpayers no longer paying taxes against which these credits and exemptions are written. We have a bill summary in front of us, Mr. Chair and members. I am going to ask if we can, Mr. Chair, so that we've got this exactly right, because it always is when Ms. Dalton does it, if Ms. Dalton could review the mechanics of the bill for us.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think it might be helpful to really look at the overview that's in the bill summary to talk about kind of the highlights of what's in it, and then I'll just do a real brief highlight of the major sections of the bill. Basically, the fare tax would, as Representative Drazkowski stated, eliminate the income tax and eliminate most excise taxes. The taxes that are not eliminated are some of the taxes like the health care provider tax and the motor fuels tax that are highly dedicated. It's not that they shouldn't be eliminated. It's just that trying to eliminate them in this bill and deal with all the dedications at the same time gets very complicated. So you should really think of this as a concept bill. Basically, the fare tax would be a very broad tax on final personal consumption. It would tax personal consumption of all goods and services, including financial services, insurance premiums, purchases from government service enterprises, you know, things that governments do that are also done by the private sector, like utilities and golf courses and things like that, and fundraising sales by nonprofits. It would also tax direct compensation when a household pays a person for providing services that would be otherwise subject to the fare tax. So if you would employ a housekeeper, those wages would be subject to the fare tax, similar to if you employed a house cleaning service. And then you would also have direct compensation paid by state and local governments to provide government services provided by a government public service enterprise would also be subject that same way. What would be exempt from the fare tax would be all business inputs. Currently about 40% of the sales tax collected in the state is actually paid by business on intermediate inputs. It would also continue to exempt spending on education, purchases by nonprofits to meet their nonprofit purposes, purchases by the federal government and by state and local governments using federal funds, mainly because this is prohibited by federal law, and investment purchases. So that gives you an idea of the broad overview. Sections 1 through 5 generally have to do with just dealing with definitions and, that are going to be necessary for this type of tax. Section 5 basically says that we're going to ask the Commissioner of Revenue to set a fare tax rate that would make this bill revenue neutral. If you look at the revenue estimate, that's estimated to be between 12.3% and 13.2%. It also adjusts the 3/8% legacy tax downward to account for to keep it revenue neutral and to account for the much broader sales tax base that it would now apply to. Section 7 lists the taxes that would be prohibited. Section 8 deals with conversions of business tax to personal use. If you convert a business purchase to a personal use, then you would owe use tax essentially on that item. Section 9 is really a work in progress. It deals with people who voluntarily register to collect the tax. This is kind of changing because we're kind of in a state of flux with the South Dakota case in front of the Supreme Court right now. We may soon have lots of people who currently don't have to collect our sales tax now subject to our tax, we hope. Well, we'll see. But so that's really kind of in a state of flux. Section 10 is the exemption section, which I've kind of talked about. Section 11 is the credits and refunds, and one of the credits and refunds is really in Section 14, and that is what Representative Draskowski talked about. It is the monthly sales tax rebate that every household, or prebate, that every household would get, and it's based on essentially consumption under the poverty level. So everybody would get essentially what they would, you know, would have an exemption for spending that would be at poverty level. Sections 12 and 13 essentially establish a process where the Commissioner of Revenue would develop legislation to actually effectuate this bill. So think of this as a concept bill. As I said, there's a lot of bells and whistles that would need to be dealt with well beyond my poor drafting ability, and the Commissioner of Revenue would work with an advisory council, an advisory commission, to figure out exactly how we would do all of the repeals and how we would do all the implementation to make this work. And for that reason, the bill has a delayed effective date.
I would disagree with one thing there. You're drafting a bill. These are exemplary. Okay, with that, Chair Draskowski, would you like to put a witness here?
I would, Mr. Chair, and I had the same comment about Mrs. Dalton's drafting ability. Just one other point before we do, Mr. Chair, and that is the revenue note on this and the fund impact, the fiscal impact, is at zero, so it's a very good bill, Mr. Chair.
Well, it's expensive than most of mine, I guess. Okay, so with that, let's go with who else. I have a one person that I have listed here to testify on behalf of. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on behalf of this bill? Anybody with concerns other than Mr. Lato, are you here? Okay, so you're on the list. Anybody else with concerns who would like to testify today? And the department?
I'm just going to listen to you.
Okay. Listen to the concept. Okay. Okay, thank you. So I got the groundwork here. So please state your name if you represent for the record, please, sir.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Daniel J. Pillai. I represent the Tax Freedom Institute and the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota, I like to think. The Tax Freedom Institute is a national association of tax practitioners, attorneys, accountants, and enrolled agents that deal specifically with tax resolution issues. I've been a tax litigator, Mr. Chairman, for over 40 years, and in my role I have seen every kind of tax case that you can imagine. I've seen a few that you probably can't imagine. In my role as a tax litigator, I've represented folks across the country and in the before the Department of Revenue in problems that they have with the Internal Revenue Service. In 1993, Mr. Chairman, I wrote a book that started the national debate on whether we should abolish the income tax, the Internal Revenue Service, the federal income tax, and go to a national retail sales tax. I wrote the first legislative model that became what later morphed into the fair tax over time. And because of my experience in this area, I've written for a number of organizations, the Foundation for Economic Education, a number of other institutions such as that, and have testified before Congress on a number of occasions on this matter, on these matters as well.
Welcome, committee.
Thank you. All right. So I've come to the conclusion, sir, in more than 40 years of dealing with people with tax problems, that the personal income tax, corporate income tax, is about the world's worst way that there is to raise revenue to fund the legitimate functions of government. We have to have a system, sir, that meets all of the essential elements, the sound elements, the sound components of a tax system. And I want to just from a 5,000-foot elevation, because this is a concept bill, I want to talk very generally about what those principles are and how a fair tax concept meets all of these principles as against an income tax. First of all, a tax system has to be simple. The system that we have now, sir, is far and away not simple. The Internal Revenue Code consists of about 4 million words, according to the National Taxpayer Advocate. The National Taxpayer Advocate has labeled tax law complexity as the number one problem that taxpayers suffer year in and year out in dealing with income tax issues. This has been in her national report, in her report to Congress every year since 1999, when the report was first covered. We like to think that Minnesota has a simple tax system, but the fact of the matter is, Mr. Chairman, as we all know here, that the state of Minnesota is swung around by the tail by federal law changes, because the starting point for Minnesota income tax is a federal adjusted or federal taxable income. So every time there's a change at the federal level, we have to absorb that here in this state, and we've got to deal with it at the state level. So it is not complex. Mr. Chairman, the number one driver of non-compliance with tax laws in the United States is tax law complexity. That's the number one driver. This gets to the point that the representative was making here in the earlier debates. Businesses don't wake up one morning. People don't wake up one morning, Mr. Chairman, and decide that they're not going to pay their taxes. They don't say to themselves, how can we tick off the Department of Revenue today? I know, we'll stop paying our taxes. That's not what happens. The number one driver is complexity. The simpler the tax system, the more compliance we get, and there's nothing simpler than a comprehensive sales tax that's assessed across the board on all consumption goods and services. The next thing, Mr. Chairman, is the tax. The tax has to be non-invasive, as non-invasive as possible. Citizens have a responsibility to pay the taxes they owe in full and on time. The government's got a responsibility to assess and collect that tax in the least invasive manner. The income tax is the most invasive type of tax system that we can possibly have, with the requirement to file tax returns, to report earnings, to citizens and businesses to be subjected to audits. The Department of Revenue enforces collection with liens, levies, and seizures. There's hundreds of thousands of federal tax liens that are filed by the state every year. There's hundreds of thousands of levies and seizures that go on every year. This is a very invasive system, and we eliminate all of that by going to a national retail sales tax, by going to a state sales tax, what we're calling the fair tax. We eliminate all of the invasiveness, and the vast majority of citizens in the state of Minnesota no longer have the responsibility to keep records and file tax returns and affirmatively pay taxes, because every time they purchase a product or service in the marketplace, the tax is collected at that point in time. The tax system has to be efficient. An income tax is the least efficient way to collect revenue. Now, the Internal Revenue Service brags that they are very efficient by collecting $100 worth of revenue with only 36 cents of cost. And if you just look, and the Department of Revenue has similar numbers, and if you just simply look at the amount collected versus the expenditure for the Department of Revenue, you know, that's probably true. But the fact of the matter is, friends, that the cost of the Department of Revenue are only one part of the problem, and frankly, the smallest part of the problem. Businesses and individuals carry a compliance cost as well. And we've estimated that the compliance cost for citizens and businesses is as much as 65% of the amount collected. In other words, for every dollar you pay in taxes, costs you another 65 cents to get it there. Now, this burden is disproportionately loaded on businesses, because three out of every $5 collected by the Department of Revenue and the Internal Revenue Service is not collected by the Department of Revenue and the Internal Revenue Service. It's collected by businesses through wage withholding that then are responsible to deposit it with the coffers of the Department of Revenue. We have 2.85 million individual tax returns filed in this state every year. We're talking about Minnesota returns. Another 680,000 corporate tax returns are filed every year. Another approximately 2.1 withholding tax payment submissions are going to the Department of Revenue every single year. So the Department of Revenue is collecting taxes from 5.63 million different collection points. That is not efficient. That is not cost savings. And if we eliminate the corporate and personal income tax, and we make this the tax collectible at the retail level on all goods and services, we dramatically reduce the collection points. We dramatically reduce the cost of compliance. We dramatically reduce the cost of administration for the Department of Revenue. The next point is the tax laws have to be stable, Mr. Chairman. We do not have a stable tax system in this country. I don't know if any of you have noticed it or not, but let me put this into some quantifiable numbers for you. Since 2001, The Internal Revenue Code has been changed more than 5,900 times. I didn't misspeak. Since 2001, the Internal Revenue Code has been changed more than 5,900 times. That does not include the recent Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which was a 700-page bill that changed even more of these code sections and subsections. And all of this madness, members of the committee, is visited on the state of Minnesota because we have to respond to all of that to adapt our own tax system. We've got over 500 changes in 2008 alone, and prior to the Jobs Act, there were 71 different provisions of the Internal Revenue Code that were subject to expiration or phase out or phase in or some, you know, influx sort of a situation. And that's even worse now under the Jobs Act because every single provision of the Jobs Act, with the exception of a few corporate provisions, are subject to expiring in 2025. Now, you contrast that, members of the committee, with what has happened, the history of what has happened with the Minnesota sales tax since it was imposed in 1967. You can count on just about one hand the number of times that the sales tax has fundamentally changed in this state. So we've got stability with a sales tax. We have no stability with an income tax. The next point, friends, is the tax has to be visible. Citizens have to know what their tax burden is. In the United States today in general, the state of Minnesota in particular, people don't know what their tax burden is. Approximately 80% of all of the citizens who file a tax return get a tax refund. They think the government got religion and gave them free money. They don't realize that they're getting a refund because they overpaid their taxes. All right? And so consequently, hidden taxes are easy to raise. Hidden taxes are easy to increase and people don't understand what's going on. Visible taxes, on the other hand, are always much more stable, which answers the question why since 1967 the state income tax is so stable compared, sales tax is so stable compared to the state income tax. It's because people see it. And when they see costs going up, they know that it's not the fault of big business. It's not the fault of big tobacco. It's not the fault of big whatever. It's the fault of big government. And so this is why it's important to have a visible tax. The next point, members of the committee, is the tax has to be neutral. Taxes have to fall equally on all businesses and all individuals. They can't fall more heavily on one segment of industry. Selecting or targeting citizens or industries for specifically increased tax liabilities, I would argue to you, is an unconstitutional use of the taxing power of government. The taxing power of government has to be used equally across all economic sectors and not just loaded onto one segment. The sales tax is a neutral tax. It falls equally, assuming the rate is uniform and assuming that we have a broad-based sales tax uniformly assessed on all consumption goods and services. That would be a neutral tax, and that is the most beneficial for the economy. And that brings me to the next point, and that is the tax has to foster economic growth. Now, here's a fact of life. All taxes create distortions in the economy. And a distortion is what economists would say causes people to do things they might not otherwise do or prevents people from doing things they otherwise would do. That's a distortion. And so the goal in tax policy is to keep the distortions to a minimum. We don't want people sitting around their dinner tables or their conference rooms saying, yes, we'd like to make this investment or yes, we'd like to do this or that activity, but we have to consider the taxes. We want the tax considerations to be last on the list, not first on the list. We have to understand, members of the committee, that this is basic economic truth. What you tax, you get less of. What you subsidize, you get more of. Our tax system, our current income tax system, taxes employment, wages, and production. Is it any surprise that we end up with less employment, wages, and production? What you tax, you get less of. Our founders specifically rejected the idea of an income tax precisely because of this reason. They opted for excise taxes generally, which, of course, the sales tax is, a broad-based excise tax. They opted for those specifically because they are more conducive to economic growth than an income tax, which burdens the engine of economic growth. And we have to take the burdens of economic growth off of our businesses and individuals in our state, and we have to do it nationally as well. A comprehensive sales tax assessed across the board on consumption goods and services is going to cause the least amount of distortion in the marketplace. It doesn't punish employment. It doesn't impede employment or production. It is the sound thing to do.
Amen.
The next thing we have to do is we have to understand that the tax has to be broad-based. All right? It has to be very broad-based. You do not raise revenue by raising rates. You raise it revenue by spreading the base as far as you possibly can. When you raise rates to the point where people are concerned about the high taxes, that is another driver of tax evasion. High rates drive tax evasion. That's second on the list. First on the list we talked about already is complexity. So we have to keep the base as broad as we possibly can. What we have now under our current income tax system is a shrinking tax base. You know, we are told, and we hear this in every election cycle, that the rich pay no taxes, that somehow we got to tax the rich. The fact of the matter is, according to Treasury Department data from 2014, the top 1% of earners, income earners, pay 40% of the tax, the top 10% pay 70% of the tax, and the bottom 50% of income earners pay 3% of the tax. That is not a broad base, and our base is narrowing. And whatever favorable things you can say about the Jobs Act and the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is going to take more people off the income tax rolls, and I don't personally believe that that's a good thing, because that's not how you raise revenue and keep rates down. The base has to be broad. What we've got here is a situation where we're taking more and more people off the tax rolls who have a right to vote for programs that are paid for out of the taxes they don't pay. And so when we adopt a broad-based consumption tax on all consumption goods and services, everybody's got skin in the game. Everybody then has a vested interest in keeping the rates low. And even though we're talking about a prebate under this system, the prebate is minimal, and it's designed to account for the lowest of the low in the economic strata, and that's fine. I understand that thinking. But the fact of the matter is, we got to get more people on the tax rolls, not less, because we need more people with a vested interest in keeping government spending down and keeping the tax rates down. The next point is the tax has to be equal. We need a tax system that is equal across the board. The crowning jewel of American liberty is the concept that all people are created equal. The opening clause of the Declaration of Independence is what Abraham Lincoln referred to as the crowning jewel of American independence, of American liberty. But under the income tax system, there's no equality. People are treated differently based only on their social strata, based only on their economic strata, and for no other reason. Under the federal income tax system, we've got 5 different filing classes that are based only on your social status. In the state of Minnesota, there's 4 different status classes. In the Internal Revenue Code, there's 6 different definitions of the word child, depending on a social status and economic strata that a person happens to be in. Minnesota has 4 income tax brackets, and those 4 income tax brackets, friends, are arbitrary. They're not based on any economic policy. They're not based on any constitutional policy. They're not based on any moral policy. They're absolutely arbitrary. And we see this year after year after year as Congress debates what the rates and schedule of rates should be. We see it in this body as well when we debate what the rates and the structure of these rates should be. And we've come to the point where we're basically throwing a dart at a board. That is not constitutional equality. That's arbitrary laws, and that has to stop. We've got a tax system that's based essentially on invidious discrimination. That's what it is. We would not tolerate that policy in any other area of law, but when it comes to tax law, we look at it as some high-minded, noble pursuit, and we embrace it as though it's some high-minded pursuit. We have to get away from that. Under a comprehensive sales tax, everybody is treated equally. Then the final point I'd like to make, Mr. Chairman, is the tax laws have to be used for constitutional purposes only. The Minnesota Constitution, Article 10, Section 1, specifically states that taxes shall be levied only for public purposes. This clause is consistent with the clause of Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution, which provides that taxes are raised for the purposes of funding paying the debts of the nation and providing for national defense and providing for general welfare. That general welfare clause is similar to our public purpose clause in the state's Constitution. Well, what this means, members of the committee, is that in order to serve a public purpose, this expenditure has to benefit everybody as a whole, not one segment of society over another, not one group of individuals over another. We call those transfer payments. Much of what goes on today through state spending and certainly at the federal level is transfer payments, not spending for the general welfare, spending that supports one group at the expense of another. The United States Supreme Court, in the case of U.S. versus Butler in 1933, said that a tax, in the general understanding of the term and as used in the Constitution, signifies an exaction for the support of government. The word has never been thought to connote the expropriation of money from one group for the benefit of another, and yet that's the point we've reached. And we didn't reach that point, friends, until 1937, when the Supreme Court, in the case of Halvering versus Davis, essentially made the decision that the General Welfare Clause means whatever Congress says it means. And that's the point we've reached. And I will tell you this, friends, as long as we have producers, as long as we have non-producers voting for government programs and getting those programs through tax payments they don't have to pay for, there's never going to be enough money to fund the programs that are thought of in these institutions. So the bottom line here, and I'll close with this, is we have an opportunity to make fundamental changes to our tax system that are going to help everybody and that is going to unleash economic power in this state like we've never seen. We abolish the personal income tax. We abolish the corporate income tax. We abolish the hodgepodge of these various other fees. We adopt one comprehensive retail sales tax assessed across the board on consumption goods and services, and we understand what the public purpose spending doctrine is, and we can bring the state's finances under control, and we can unleash economic resources, economic activity in the state like we've never seen before. We can make the entire state of Minnesota an enterprise zone. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, now, please, let's have some decorum here. Let's not get out of control.
I thought that was.
Now, I'll put you down, Mr. Pillow. You're for the bill?
That would be a yes, Mr.
Okay,
Chairman.
Okay, thank you, sir. Thank you for your testimony. Let's go to Mr. Leto, and then we'll go to members' questions for both Mr. Pillow and Mr. Leto. Thank you for your testimony, sir.
My pleasure.
Please state your name as you represent for the record, please, sir.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Brad Leto, Legislative Director, Chief of Staff for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And I appreciate the opportunity to make some very brief comments today. And I am happy to hear that this is a concept bill. It probably come no surprise to you that the Minnesota AFL-CIO opposes the concept of House File 2716. Elimination of the personal income taxes and corporate taxes and replacing these taxes with a larger sales tax would make Minnesota's tax system more aggressive, we believe. The bill would throw out all the progressivity of the income tax system for a broad sales tax or fair tax, as the author has termed the provision. Of course, we do not look at this as a fair tax. But I won't go through point by point. But I have two more reasons that this bill is a solution in search of a problem. First of all, this bill has a delayed effective date, 2020. It seems that such a massive change in the Minnesota's tax system should not be undertaken with 7 working weeks left in the 2018 legislative session. Second, and as importantly, the issue of federal tax conformity, how much, what provisions, and what effect are vital issues, is a vital issue this session. So I've testified previously, the Minnesota AFL-CIO stands ready to assist the committee in a conformity discussion. Yeah, I would hope 2716 will not be the method of conformity chosen, and we believe it is most certainly the wrong way to go. Minnesota AFL-CIO again opposes this concept, but I repeat, we stand ready to work with the administration and the legislature on conformity legislation. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Lesper. So you are kind of warming up to the concept? Or?
I would say we're as cold as ice on this concept.
Oh, a 2013 tax bill. Border, yeah. Cold as ice.
I would not use that term in the 2013 tax bill, but you would, I know. I
understand. You're willing to sacrifice. Yeah, okay. Okay. So with that, we'll go to questions from members on they can either address Mr. Leto or Mr. Pillar. Okay, so let's go with Mr. Gruenhagen, Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thank you, Representative Drazkowski, for bringing this bill forward and starting the discussion.
You know, I appreciate the testimony regarding this. I spent quite a bit of time myself kind of looking at the flat tax or the fair tax or those types of taxes, the amount of simplification it would produce and also the economic growth. And you've kind of touched on that in your testimony. But, you know, in 2016, the MMB said Minnesota's private sector economy grew at 1.2%. We cannot meet the needs of this state at 1.2%, okay? Especially when government's growing at quite a bit faster than that. From what I've read, the if you would simplify and go to a tax like you're talking, you could bump GDP in a state or a nation by 2 to 3% or more per year. Would you confirm that or say that's a realistic expectation? And I have a follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Representative, to answer your question, yes, I would confirm that. If you look at the states that have no income tax that function essentially off of the sales tax, talking about Florida, Texas, Alaska, Tennessee, South Dakota, there's a couple of other ones, the growth in those states is more consistently higher than the growth in states that have income taxes. And so I think that's the evidence. We hear all the time objections about this as saying, well, there aren't models that will help us to determine whether this works or not. That's not true. We've got models in these states, and Texas in particular, Florida in particular. You look at these states, you see the level of growth that they have, and absolutely we would have the same growth here. Mr. Chairman, is it appropriate for me to respond to a remark that Mr. Letko made in his testimony?
We're on questions for members now.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Hagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just share on a bipartisan basis that if we can get the Minnesota economy growing at a 3-4% rate versus a 1.2, it's going to generate billions of additional taxes. Now, your side of the aisle tends to want to grow government with that money. We tend to want to reduce government on this side. That we can have the debate, but to understand that the current tax code is like an albatross on economic growth, I think that's where we can come together. And by simplifying, looking at an option like this, we will see much greater private sector growth, which translates into higher tax revenues without raising taxes. And I'd encourage those people on the other side of the aisle to think that through and that we could come together to reform this tax code so our private sector can grow at a faster rate, generating the money we need to, you know, waste water plants, I mean, roads and bridges, just one right after the other. You know, our current tax code, federal and state, reminds me of an exercise in the Marine Corps that they used to put people through who didn't behave themselves. And if you didn't behave yourself in the Marine Corps, they took you out and you dug a hole all day and then you filled it up at the end of the day. Okay? Now it created a lot of jobs.
We have a question to one of the witnesses. We have another bill. So
okay.
If you have a question, go ahead.
No, I'll pass on that. I think
okay. Any other questions? If
Representative Mark. Oh, no, not a question. Chair, just a comment.
Sure.
So, first of all, I appreciate the discussion. I really wish we had more time to do this, and I know we've got a lot of bills during committee, but, you know, just talking about different types of tax concepts, and we don't really have enough time usually to talk about that because we're talking about bills, and, you know, we talk about the three-legged stool and so forth, and we don't, you know, our current system, we don't know for sure if that's the best way to go or not. I mean, we don't. I think there's too much reliance on property taxes, and would like to see something do, but looking at this one, my biggest concern would be, and I think brought up early, it would be kind of the fairness and the incidence. You know, you're taking, right now, the income tax is 53% of our state revenues, progressive tax. And so what you'd be doing is eliminating that and replacing with 100% regressive. So even with the credit that's there, I think it would make us more regressive quite a bit. And I don't think it's fair that, you know, if you've got a senior citizen on a fixed income, that they should be paying more of their state and local, taxes of their income than someone who's wealthier. You know, they shouldn't be paying more of that in percentage. And that's what we have right now in our tax incident study. And I think this would only get worse. And I think when you create an unfairness like that, it creates some problems. So, I mean, I think it's, you know, like, I learned a lot today. This has been good, and I wish, seriously, we had more time to discuss things. But I do think it's not moving in the right direction when you got folks in the middle income that pay, you know, more of their income in state and local taxes than someone on the higher end. And so I don't know how you really, you know, this would move us in the wrong direction on that respect. But, you know, Representative Drazkowski, thank you.
Would you like
for bringing
up
this forward.
Representative Drazkowski?
Mr. Chairman, may I respond to the representative's comment?
Just comments. It's not a question. Representative Drazkowski, would you like to wrap it up?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. This is a very good discussion, and I agree. Representative Markwart, we need to go in more depth on this type of discussion. Representative Gruenhagen, and I appreciate your comments. We do need to get this economy going. We do need to have a tax system that is fair, and this would get us in that direction. So I look forward to more discussion on this in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Pillow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you.
Chair Drazkowski renews his motion at House File 2716 as the amended relator for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Chair Drazkowski, and to the testifiers. Members, just we're not going to be able to get back to the department bill, but we will be working on that next week. So just I have the list. I have Erickson, Petersburg, Guttmer, and I'm not forgetting you. You will be able to ask your questions. So we will look for the schedule. Sometime next week we will bring this bill back up, and we'll pick up probably – oh, heat pumping? No, apparently. Okay. So, no, it's a page turner, like I said. Okay, so put that back in your file, if you would, so we have it, and we will pick up. Nobody will be cut off from questions or anything like that. So with that being said, I will move House File 3566. I would move the H3566A1 amendment. That's an author's amendment. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. We now have the bill as amended before us. And Ms. Dalton, is this one of yours, too? Great. Man, you did a good job of that.
Mr. Chair, this is your bill.
Well, it's my bill. Could you please describe my bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill makes two changes to the marketplace provider's sales tax provisions that were included in the omnibus tax bill last year. The first change is very technical, and it really relates to how do we apply the $10,000 de minimis exemption if a retailer is selling through more than one marketplace provider. And so basically, as long as they certify to the marketplace provider that they're making less than $10,000 of sales into the state in a year, and that marketplace provider verifies that they aren't selling more than $10,000 through their marketplace, then they are not liable for collecting for that retailer. The second provision allows the marketplace provider to shift fiscal responsibility to the retailer that they are collecting for sales tax underpayments discovered by audit under certain circumstances. And the main circumstances are they have to have an agreement with the retailer that they are collecting on behalf of, and they have to provide that information to the Department of Revenue with sufficient information so the Department of Revenue can go after that retailer for those uncollected taxes.
Okay, that's what the bill does as amended. Is there anyone that would wish to testify on behalf of the bill? I believe we have Mr. Bruce Newstead, if he's come down. Anyone else on behalf of the bill? Oh, you're not on behalf, you're with concerns? You just want to talk.
That's fine.
Yeah, welcome to the committee.
Thanks.
Okay, and then the department?
Sure.
Has some comments? Okay, thank you, Mr. Cummings. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Newstead. I'm with the Minnesota Retailers Association. We represent small, regional, and large retailers. About a third of our membership is in each of those buckets. Just a quick thank you to the committee and the legislature for the great work you did in 2013 relative to passing sales tax fairness. That established a physical nexus, which was great for retailers and great for consumers, quite frankly, as well. Last year, as Ms. Dalton mentioned, you established and turned that into and expanded that to more of an economic nexus, which made great sense, and we thank you for that as well. I just wanted to address one area of quick concern on the bill as drafted right now related to the assignment of financial liability. Well, I am sure the good actors in the marketplace would use that in the way that they should, and it's intended to address any incidental or accidental errors in sales tax collection. Our concern is that it creates a gap, a pretty gaping gap for those that do not or are not the good actors but are rather the bad actors. So we have a little bit of concern with relative to how that would play out in the marketplace, certainly an understanding of what it's intended to do, but it might create a bigger hole than what I think is intended, Mr. Chair. So we look forward to working with you a little more deeply on the language.
And then, Mr. Newsom, what part of the bill are you referring to?
Yeah, the assignment of financial liability section, Mr. Chair.
Do you have the bill before you?
I do, yes. So look at the line
2.8. 2.8 to 2.1.
And 2.1 there's a reference there as well. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Questions for Mr. Newstead? Okay, thank you. To the department? Please state your name if you represent for the record, please, sir.
For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, committee.
I was able to text you yesterday with a few concerns. This bill makes the following two changes to the marketplace provider sales tax provision, clarifies the application of the $10,000 de minimis exception, and allows the marketplace provider to shift fiscal responsibility to the retailer for sales tax underpayments discovered by audit under certain circumstances. We appreciated hearing about the description from Ms. Dalton. We were hoping to hear, I guess, from the advocates about what their intent was in bringing this forward. But as we're looking at this proposal, we think it will cause confusion for taxpayers and the department. The language provides that the commissioner must assign fiscal liability to the retailer for underpayment of taxes, but the law does not provide that a retailer becomes liable for a tax through the commissioner assigning them liability, and there's no authority for the commissioner to do so. The term fiscal liability is undefined and ambiguous. It's used a few times, and so even the word fiscal, if the word fiscal were deleted, does liability refer to the obligation of the retailer to collect and remit, or does it refer to an assessment by the commissioner or both? No law change would be needed for a marketplace provider to enter into an agreement to require a retailer to register, collect, and remit sales tax. Such an agreement would be an option that would be that would necessarily eliminate the above concerns regarding the fiscal liability agreement language. We encourage the committee to look at other similar instances in statute that work well. It may make sense that marketplace providers facilitating their sales to be treated similarly to retailers with certified service providers, or CSPs. A CSP files and remits sales tax, and the liability for taxes would fall to the retailer only if the retailer misrepresented the type of items that it sells or committed fraud. This is in 297A.995 sub 9. There's no reference in the CSP language that says that the CSP is not liable if its retailers enter an agreement with the CSP regarding assigning them fiscal liability. But if we look sort of at a higher level, Mr. Chair, I think the approach that would work the best in this case is an act of Congress or the Supreme Court overturning Quill. Either of these would allow marketplaces the ability to ensure that they can provide the service of collecting and remitting taxes without the liability risks, because the retailer using the marketplace will, without any doubt, have nexus. Yet this marketplace law that is being amended here does continue to have value. It was once asked by some of the advocates of bills that are like this if we would ask one of our large malls in Minnesota, physical malls, to collect and remit sales tax on behalf of retailers within that mall. And that was asked within sort of the context of the marketplace law that was passed last session.
So if one of the Dales out there, should they be having to collect and remit? And really my response to this question was, there, if there was a mall where none of the retailers inside the mall paid sales tax, then I think we would probably be seeking a legislative solution to ask the mall to ensure that sales tax was being collected and remitted amongst the people working there. So, Mr. Chair, as this bill moves through the process, the Department of Revenue looks forward to continuing to work with you and members and staff, and we thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
I think we're close. Any questions for members? I think you said take an act of Congress.
Mr. Chair, they...
if I had a nickel for every time I heard that one.
Well, it could take an act of Congress. It also could take an act of the Supreme Court. And I know that you have many connections there. So
the situation is fluid, we'll say. Any questions for members? Okay, with that, members, I will move to lay House File 3566 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Members, thank you today so much for your work and for all the testifiers. They were before us. I really appreciate it. With that, good government all the time, we are adjourned.